Good morning. American troops are already in Israel. We'll ask former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Jack Liu, how to ensure the ceasefire holds and how Gaza will rebuild after so much has been destroyed. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration told thousands of federal workers they were fired because of the shutdown, then told some it was all a mistake. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. The cuts hit the IRS, Education Department, and CDC, among others. Also, how Trump freezing university research grants is helping keep a four-year-old boy tethered to his hospital room. It's Monday, October 13th. Today, in 1903, the Boston Americans, better known now as the Red Sox, beat the Pittsburgh Pirates to win the first World Series of baseball's modern era. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. In the Middle East this morning, a historic day as all 20 remaining living Israeli hostages have been freed by Hamas. All are men, mostly in their 20s and 30s. The remains of 28 dead hostages are also due to be released, although the Palestinian group says it has not been able to locate all of them. NPR's Kerry Khan has more on the unfolding scene from Jerusalem.
Hamas has been turning over the 20 living hostages to the International Committee of the Red Cross on mourning. The Israeli military escorts them across the border for transfer to local hospitals. Videos of the released hostages with loved ones are being played on local media. One mother says she, quote, screamed to the sky seeing her son. Cheers erupted as the images of the released hostages are transmitted to tens of thousands gathering in a downtown Tel Aviv plaza dubbed Hostages Square. In Gaza, hospital officials are preparing for the return of Palestinian prisoners expected from Israeli custody later today. In all, 2,000 Palestinian detainees and prisoners will be released. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The release began early today just as President Trump arrived in Israel, telling reporters aboard Air Force One,
"Everybody is happy, whether it's Jewish or Muslim or the Arab countries. Every country is dancing in the streets, and it's a point in time I don't think you'd ever see it again."
Trump is due to speak to the Israeli parliament and then head to Egypt for what's being dubbed as a peace summit. The office of Egyptian President Mahmoud Abbas is telling reporters that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will participate in the summit talks to, as he states, consolidate the ceasefire agreement in Gaza and reaffirm commitment to it. Long-running trade frictions between China and the United States are flaring anew. But Chinese statistics show that the country's trade is still going strong. NPR's John Ruich has details from Beijing.
Chinese exports accelerated in September, rising 8.3% from the same month last year. That's up from 4.4% growth in August and the fastest in half a year. It also beat analysts' expectations. A Reuters poll predicted export growth of 6%. Imports also jumped in September, up 7.4% from the same month last year, according to government statistics. The strong numbers could be wind in the sails of Chinese trade negotiators as the two countries face an impasse ahead of a planned meeting between Chinese leader Xi Jinping and President Trump in South Korea around the end of the month. Beijing introduced fresh measures to control exports of rare earth minerals last week. President Trump responded by announcing a sharp increase in tariffs on Chinese goods and limits on software exports to China. John Ruich, NPR News, Beijing.
Recapping, all 20 remaining living Israeli hostages have been freed. This is NPR. In Stockholm, the Nobel Prize in Economics has been awarded to Joel Mocher, Philippe Aguillon, and Peter Howitt for having explained innovation-driven economic growth, with one half to Mocher for having identified the prerequisites for sustained growth through technological progress, and the other half jointly to Philippe Aguillon and Peter Howitt, quote, for the theory of sustained growth through creative destruction. A storm system working its way up the East Coast created hazardous conditions from the Carolinas to New England. Heavy rain and gusty winds are expected to continue today. NPR's Joe Hernandez has details.
Much of the East Coast is feeling the effects of the system, including rain, strong winds, and the potential for flooding. The National Weather Service says wind gusts over 55 miles per hour are possible across the mid-Atlantic and into southern New England. According to forecasters, the storm is creating especially hazardous conditions conditions along the shore, including rip currents. Major coastal flooding is also a concern from Virginia to New Jersey. At least one town in Delaware was under a voluntary evacuation order due to the threat of coastal floods. The storm is also hampering air travel. The Federal Aviation Administration issued weather-related ground delays at several major airports in Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Diane Keaton's legacy being recalled by fans and fellow actors a couple of days after word of her death. Her Oscar-winning performances live on in film classics, including The Godfather and Annie Hall. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Somewhere around 1929, the hip pain began. George Morrison was 10, but far away from his family in his Chippewa community in Minnesota's Arrowhead near Grand Marais. Instead, he was in Hayward, Wisconsin, at the Hayward Indian School, where the sanitary conditions were atrocious and disease rife.
But tuberculosis still kills 23,000 people each year. Of these, half are...
Morrison's left hip was killing him, so it was decided to send him back to Minnesota, first to a sanatorium and then to a children's hospital in St. Paul, where he was treated for tuberculosis of the bone. Already showing a talent for art, he spent his convalescence drawing. More surgeries followed, with more periods of convalescence, which the young boy used to hone his eye and his hand as he channeled pain and inactivity into a burst of creativity. Years later, the adult George Morrison, still limping on his hip, would be acclaimed as one of the great abstract artists of post-war America.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump is about to speak to Israel's legislature this morning. His speech in front of the Knesset comes after the first phase of a peace deal he helped broker went into effect. Today, Hamas freed all 20 surviving Israeli hostages it captured during the October 7th attacks, and buses carrying freed Palestinian prisoners arrived in the West Bank.
Joining us now is NPR's Greg Myrie, who is in Tel Aviv. Greg, what message will Trump deliver?
Yeah, as Trump arrived at Israel's parliament, the Knesset in Jerusalem, he could be heard saying that this is a great day. The president clearly sees this as a great success, and he wants to celebrate this ceasefire. On the flight here, Trump spoke briefly with reporters on the plane and said emphatically, the war is over. So that is certainly the hope of the message that Trump has come to convey. But we should note that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu hasn't gone this far. He seems to want to keep his options open in case there are some problems that develop down the road.
Okay, so to give us a sense of how Trump was greeted in Israel.
Yeah, it's really overwhelming. He got a literal red carpet welcome at Ben-Gurion Airport outside Tel Aviv. Netanyahu was there to greet him. Trump's daughter, Ivanka, and her husband, Jared Kushner, were there. They've been here for the past couple days, and he helped negotiate the ceasefire agreement. Now, more broadly, Israel has just embraced Trump in the most spectacular way imaginable. We've seen crowds at Hostages Square chant, thank you, Trump. Thank you, Trump. I'd note that the same crowd has booed Netanyahu. They believe Netanyahu rejected earlier opportunities to end the war. Huge billboards featuring Trump have cropped up all over the country. And on the beachfront in Tel Aviv, Trump's distinctive profile was carved in the sand, accompanied by a big thank you with an Israeli flag.
Wow. All right. Now, what role will President Trump and his administration have in the next stages of the Gaza ceasefire?
Yeah, so the plan A is for the Trump administration to remain very active. About 200 American troops are being sent to Israel. At least some are already here. here. I know this because I see them walking around my hotel in uniform. Now, they'll be part of a military-civilian coordination center, and this will also involve other countries, all of them trying to keep the ceasefire on track. The U.S. contingent is led by Navy Admiral Brad Cooper, the head of U.S. Central Command, so a very senior figure. This U.S. presence, this military presence, is a sign that the Trump administration really wants this ceasefire to stick. But we should stress that the Americans and the others will be doing things like planning, logistics, transportation, and they'll be doing it from a safe distance inside Israel. These U.S. forces will not be in Gaza.
Okay, got it. The president is going to be in Israel for just a couple of hours. Can you tell us what's next for him?
Yeah, so Trump will be flying to Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, on the Red Sea later today. That's where this formal signing ceremony for the ceasefire will take place. 20 or so national leaders are supposed to be there. Today is a day of success and celebration, but the important point to emphasize here, this is stage one. Much harder stages are ahead and will play out for weeks, months, even years to come.
All right, that's NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing.
For one perspective on what could or even should happen next in Gaza, we've called Jack Liu. He was U.S. ambassador to Israel in the Biden administration, and before that, Treasury Secretary serving under President Obama. He's currently a professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University. Ambassador Liu, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us on this consequential day.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So, look, you can look at any of the images coming out of Gaza for an idea of the challenge. I mean, entire neighborhoods, including people who once lived there, buried under tons of rubble, homes, hospitals, schools, sanitation, infrastructure, all destroyed. What do you even do first?
Well, first, you have to recognize the significance of today. The release of all of the living hostages ends 2 years of trauma, and it is a moment where things can actually turn to a new day. So this is something that for the 14 months I was in Israel and the 9 months since I've come home has been something you could only hope for. And for the families, for the country of Israel, it's a moment to breathe again. Mm-hmm. In Gaza, the destruction is broad. The people have been suffering. I spent every day and every night trying to help brings humanitarian support to civilians there. That work has to go on. The difference is it's going to be going on in an environment where there's a ceasefire. That means that instead of struggling to get 100 trucks a day in, it'll be possible to get 500-600 trucks a day in. That means there'll be enough food and medical supplies in Gaza that relief workers can work in much greater safety and provide the needed services to people. That's going to give a little bit of breathing room, but it doesn't address what comes next in terms of rebuilding Gaza. I think the question that remains is, will this ceasefire stick? Will we be able to get from phase one to phase two and then finally phase three? And I think the key ingredient is going to be sustained U.S. engagement because it's only the U.S. that can bring all the parties together to make that happen.
I was going to ask you about that because there has been a ceasefire war. It broke down. The Israelis occupy about half of Gaza still. The key factor in making sure the ceasefire holds will be what?
Look, I think that the fact that the 20 living hostages are released, the next step is going to be the release of the remains of the 28 hostages who died. That's going to be more challenging. There's some question as to how easier possible it would be to identify where they all are. There's going to have to be a good faith effort there. And I hope that we'll see in the coming hours and the coming days that that starts to build a little bit of confidence. The meeting that will take place later today in Sharm el-Sheikh is very important because all of the Arab countries there, all of the leading countries of the world that have come together in Sharm el-Sheikh are going to be talking about how do you move forward to start to rebuild, to create some interim governance, to ultimately have a future where there can be more normal life in Gaza. It won't be in a day or two. It's mm-hmm. going to take a very long time. And the sustained engagement, even the 200 CENTCOM troops that have been deployed in Israel, they're going to play a hugely important function. Today, in an underground room in the north of Israel, there's American soldiers who are helping to make sure that the mechanism in Lebanon is enforced every hour of every day. That's the kind of work these soldiers will be doing. And CENTCOM is the best in the world at logistics and making those things work. It's only an enabling thing. You have to bring the parties to a place where in Gaza, Hamas is willing to disarm, and Israel is willing to take these steps forward. That's going to take ongoing engagement.
Let me ask you about that, though, given Hamas has not, as of this moment, disarmed, and it seems that there are likely other militias in Gaza. So is it likely, then, that the U.S. will have to play a role in disarming Hamas?
So I think the reality is there's so many people in Gaza with guns that you have to distinguish between getting the last guns out of Gaza and Hamas as a military force being disarmed. I think Hamas can be disarmed as an organized military force. I think it's going to take a security force on the ground. That's what the international force is for, to make sure that the control of a street in a neighborhood doesn't go to whoever has a gun. Hmm. Those are different questions. So I think the security of Israel can be protected. The security in Gaza is going to take having some stability on the ground, which is why this international effort to bring some kind of security force in while Gazans, while Palestinians are being trained and brought back into service on their own is crucial. It can't happen overnight. It's not something that's a switch that you can just turn on.
So just if I can just ask you, thinking about how we got here, we heard last week from Gershon Baskin, a veteran hostage negotiator for Israel who was involved in back channel discussions about this peace deal. He told us he negotiated a deal with Hamas in September 2024 to end the war, but a top advisor to President Biden would not look at it.
I sat with two members of Biden's team in Tel Aviv, and they were so frustrated that we couldn't get the Biden people to move on the possibility of ending the war within 3 weeks. Trump is a different story. Netanyahu is a Republican, and Trump has the ability to tell Netanyahu what to do, and Netanyahu cannot say no to Trump.
So that's one point of view now to yours. Did the Biden administration fail to seriously move forward on a deal that was essentially what was just agreed to?
Look, on the substance of what was just agreed to, the diplomatic work was hammered out by our team, by Bill Burns and Brett McGurk in their extraordinary diplomatic effort that led to the January ceasefire and laid the foundation for the release of the hostages today. There was a different situation on the ground. Since those months in 2024, we've seen the destruction of Hezbollah. We've seen Iran rendered to be a much less dangerous force in the region and to Israel. And we've seen a different American president take office. I think one of the things, and you're seeing it today in the pictures from Israel, left and right in Israel are very much behind what President Trump is doing, which gives him enormous ability to put pressure on both the prime minister in Israel and on other parties in the region. I think it was very much the case that there was a reluctance on the part of the Netanyahu government to agree to an all-for-all, all the hostages, all the prisoners, end to the war at the moment we were in. This is a different moment, and yes, it's a different president whose disruptive style, whose unique ability to create uncertainty has led to something very good today. So I think we have to give credit there.
We're going to leave it there for now. So much more to talk about. Jack Liu is a former U.S. ambassador to Israel. He served in the Biden administration. Ambassador, thank you so much.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
This is NPR News.
Debuting on October 16th, KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature. PR comes from this station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Enemy Martinez, when the Trump administration canceled more than $10 billion in university research funding in response to what it said were civil rights violations on campus, it didn't just affect schools themselves. People all across the country felt it. Parents in clinical trials, farmers waiting for innovations in agriculture, high schoolers getting help with their math homework. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports on one canceled medical research grant and what it means for a Philadelphia family and their four-year-old son.
For the last two decades, Jim Antaki has been working on creating an implantable artificial heart for babies and infants.
It's about the size of a AA battery.
Antaki is a biomedical engineer at Cornell University in New York.
It takes blood from the heart, increases the pressure and the flow, and then boosts it into circulation.
About 1 in 100 babies in the U.S. are born with congenital heart defects. But there's no artificial heart specifically designed for babies or young kids with the most serious ailments. The FDA has identified this as an area of critical medical device need.
The current technology involves pumps that are outside the body and are really only useful for short periods of time because they have significant adverse effects, such as stroke.
Antaki's device, which as of last spring was in the final stages of research and manufacturing before clinical trials, will be different. It'll be implanted inside the body. He keeps the prototype in his pocket and frequently glides his fingers over it.
It's like my security blanket, and it's so close to being used to save lives and children.
But the project came to a grinding halt last April when the Trump administration canceled his $6 million multi-year grant.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking and it's frustrating.
Not this again, Mom.
What? Not what again?
You!
It's even more frustrating for a mom and her four-year-old son in Philadelphia. They haven't been able to leave the hospital for months.
Not you again.
Oh, sorry, you're stuck with me.
Little Caleb is on one of those artificial heart pumps outside the body, called a VAD.
Mom?
Yeah?
What does VAD stand for?
Oh, well, what type of heart do you have?
Single ventricle.
Yeah. And how many ventricles does a typical heart have?
Two.
Nora Strickland explains to her son that because he only has one ventricle, he needs a ventricular-assisted device, or VAD, to keep his heart pumping while he waits for a heart transplant, which could take a year if he's lucky.
Lift me up.
Lift you up? Okay.
The artificial heart device is filled with blood, and it hangs from Caleb's skinny little frame. The IKIS driver, which powers the device, is on wheels, weighs about 200 pounds, and can be only unplugged for about 30 minutes.
I'm going to unplug Taco.
Caleb nicknamed the machine Taco Bell, and when he goes down the hall to the playroom, he basically has 20 minutes to get himself plugged back in. The wheeled pole with all his blood-thinning medicines, that one also comes along.
You're going to have to push broccoli.
It's called broccoli. He also named his heart pump, or VAD, Henry, after his favorite train character on Thomas the Tank Engine. These are his constant companions.
And we're taking all three of them with us?
We have to, because Look, they're connected to me. See, they're connected to me.
All right.
This is my van. It holds my heart. Let's go.
For the doctors working with young children in heart failure, innovation in the devices that power those little hearts can't come fast enough.
This deserves our attention. This deserves our resources. This deserves people working together.
Dr. John Edelson is a pediatric cardiologist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He tells me the VAD that Caleb is on works extremely well. But they're large. They need to be plugged into a power supply. And the hardest part?
Kids can't go home on it, which is even harder than the limitations in mobility. And that's a very real thing and a very hard thing and something that I hope will not be a forever thing.
C-A-L-E and then B. What does that spell?
Caleb.
I mean my name.
You made your name.
I mean my name.
Caleb was born with a congenital heart defect, but it was a virus that sent his already weak heart into failure and landed him living in the hospital. Caleb's mom, Nora, told me in this hospital room, they feel so far away from the Trump administration's disputes with universities. And yet they're still being impacted by those decisions and those policies that they have no control over. When Nora is feeling a bit helpless, Caleb is philosophical about it.
Could be worse. Could be worse. Could be worse, Mom.
It could always be worse, bud.
But later, Nora told me it could also be better. She took a leave of absence from her job to be able to stay at the hospital with Caleb. She says if her son could have a portable implant, like the one Dr. Antaki was working on,
Caleb could go to the playground. He'd be home, and he'd be out and about. He wouldn't need to be plugged into a wall, and he wouldn't be tethered.
She wants to know why research that could help families like hers would be canceled. Dr. Antaki does too.
We feel like collateral damage.
He says he doesn't see the link between what he's working on, medical device research, and accusations of campus wokeness or anti-Semitism.
This is no reason to punish us. We're trying to do good in the world.
When asked why Dr. Antaki's research was canceled, the grant officer at the Department of Defense, which facilitates the grant, said in an email that it was, quote, at the direction of the administration, and provided no further details. This summer, when the FDA added pediatric ventricular devices to its medical device shortage list, I reached out to the Department of Health and Human Services about the irony of canceling a grant focused on developing just that. A spokesperson did not provide comment on Dr. Antaki's grant. He did say, quote, ensuring the public has access to safe and effective medical devices is a top priority for the FDA. For Antaki, that's no salve.
I'm becoming increasingly demoralized, as you can imagine, because I don't see any way out of this predicament unless this funding is unfrozen.
One hope is that Cornell makes a deal with the Trump administration. Both Columbia University and Brown University have agreed to deals to restore research funding. Cornell officials say they are currently in talks with the federal government. But it's now been nearly 6 months since Antaki's lab has had to stop all work. He hasn't found alternative funding, his grad students have left, and his key technician on the project was laid off by Cornell. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News, Philadelphia.
This is NPR News.
Hundreds of detainees are being held in the rural city of Folkston, Georgia.
This is the largest ICE processing facility in the United States right here.
It's a move that has led to a debate about the ethics of profiting from immigrant detention. We'll hear from residents of Folkston on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon here on People Powered KAXC with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 529. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show. Coming up in just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. John will look back at his nature notes for this date, October 13th. Weather for today, mostly sunny. We do have a slight chance of showers early, especially on the Iron Range. Highs in the mid-50s with breezy west winds. Partly cloudy tonight, lows 30 to 33, and tomorrow partly sunny with highs in the low 50s. Adventures in Lifelong Learning continues its fall season every Tuesday, 10 a.m. at the Bemidji Eagles Club. Coffee and treats are served beginning at 9:40 with a variety of speakers each week. Find a full schedule on Facebook. Look for Bemidji Adventures in Lifelong Learning. The Minnesota DNR and Minnesota Forestry Association will host a series of webinars for landowners in response to summer storm damage in the Bemidji area. The first webinar is 4 o'clock today. It's about common tree pests and diseases. There will be two more webinars in this series, the second Monday of November and the second Monday in December. Learn more and register at minnesotaforestry.org/blowdown. Kootaska Community Action in Grand Rapids is collecting gently used kids' Halloween costumes now until October 15th. Costumes may be dropped off at the former Murphy Elementary building from 9 to 4 on weekdays. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Also, you can find this week's events up north at our website, kaxc.org. You can take a walk on the Haunted Trail at Northland Arboretum in Brainerd, October 16th through the 18th, 7 to 9 each evening. Choose from low scare, high scare, or insane high scare options. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, October 13th, 2008, as I was duck hunting in the Boy River Bay area of Leech Lake, this broad expanse of sedges and cattails, phragmites, and grasses are dominated by these soaring hawks. Most of the ones I see this time of year are females. They're larger than the males. They are dark brown and have a white rump patch. The males are silver with the same white rump patch. But the females seem to be the latter when it comes to leaving the area by migration. So watch for these big floating hawks who can hover so gracefully or turn just instantaneously as they're moving 5, 6, 8 feet above the grasses and dive down and capture their prey and consume it right there as they nourish themselves for the continued migration to the south.
In New York.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Amazon Prime Video, presenting Lazarus from mystery writer Harlan Coben, a tale of lies, murder, and long-buried family secrets starring Sam Claflin and Bill Nighy, premieres October 22nd on Prime Video. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
Thousands of federal workers received layoff notices Friday as a government shutdown continues. At least some of those intended firings have already, though, been walked back.
The Trump administration continues to blame Democrats for drastic changes to the federal government, but these are changes that have also been part of the president's day one agenda. This as members of the military face the prospect of their first missed paycheck this week.
NPR's Stephen Fowler has been keeping track of these changes, joining us now to help sort all of this out. So, Stephen, we're heading into the second week of the government shutdown. Friday, the White House announced substantial layoffs were coming for federal employees. Where do those now stand?
So about 4,000 people from at least seven agencies received these reduction in force notices. That includes places like the IRS, the Education Department, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. A quarter of those layoffs were with the Department of Health and Human Services. Sources told NPR that more than 100 employees at the country's top mental health agency will be let go, plus hundreds more at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That was Friday. On Saturday, some CDC employees started receiving word that their layoff notices were being reversed. We don't know the scope and scale of that decision, but I did hear from a few folks who are the so-called disease detectives that work on investigating outbreaks who say their cuts were walked back.
Okay. Now, Vice President J.D. Vance was asked about those reversals on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday. This is what he had to say.
So you ask, how does this mistake happen? It happened because Chuck Schumer shut down the government, and we're trying to make sure that essential services still function in the face of that shutdown.
Okay, take us through the Trump administration's logic here.
Well, the administration argues that Democrats' refusal to drop their demands for extending health care subsidies means they have to start firing workers and cutting spending to keep the lights on for essential government services. Budget experts say that's not how that works. Those essential services continue no matter how many people work for the government because they're essential. The federal employees who keep doing their jobs during the shutdown will get paid once a new spending plan is passed. Beyond that, firing workers and slashing spending has been a top Trump administration priority since day one, like the Department of Government efficiency effort. And also like DOGE, some government experts I talked to last week before the firings were announced said to take any threats and big changes with a grain of salt, like Jessica Riedel with the center-right Manhattan Institute.
There's a lot of people in the government right now who were pretty sure their jobs were going to be eliminated 6 months ago, but are still employed by the federal government.
In fact, in recent weeks before the shutdown, we've been reporting on federal agencies hiring people back because they can't perform basic functions or carry out Trump's agenda.
Okay, so there are some layoffs, except for the ones that are being reversed. This week is also the first potential missed paycheck for military members. Is that really going to happen?
Over the weekend, President Trump posted on his social media site Truth Social that he would make sure the troops are paid. A Pentagon official not authorized to speak publicly told NPR that they would take about $8 billion of unused research, development, testing, and evaluation funds to cover the paychecks for October 15th. It's not clear if they can legally do that, but like many big changes to the federal government this year, the White House says it's using power over appropriations that belongs to Congress.
All right, that's NPR's Stephen Fowler. Stephen, thanks.
Thank you.
About 460 of those reduction in force notices on Friday went to workers at the U.S. Department of Education. NPR education correspondent Corey Turner spent the weekend trying to figure out what parts of the department were hit hardest. That's when he began hearing from staff that the Trump administration gutted the office that oversees special education. And Corey's with us now to tell us more. Good morning, Corey.
Good morning, Michelle.
What more can you tell us about this office and why it matters?
Yeah, so a little history lesson here. 50 years ago this year, Congress passed the landmark Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. So that law guarantees kids with disabilities from birth to 21 the right to a free and appropriate public education. This was a huge deal. Before this law, kids with disabilities could be and were legally turned away from schools, even public schools. Federal law also created a standalone office to oversee special education and help states follow the law and hold them accountable when they don't. And this, Michelle, is the office the Trump administration just decimated. I spoke with six staffers who all received RIF notices and agreed to speak only on the condition of anonymity because they were very worried the Trump administration would retaliate against them. They told me nearly the entire staff, dozens of employees, were laid off, except for a handful of top executives and their support staff. One person told me, quote, "This is decimating the office responsible for safeguarding the rights of infants, toddlers, children, and youth with disabilities.
So if people maybe don't have a child with disabilities, maybe they don't think about this. So what might stop if this office can't do its job?
Yeah, so every year, that law I mentioned requires that states do a bunch of things. They have to send data to the education department, like graduation and dropout rates, for their students with disabilities. And we're talking about 7.5 to 8 million kids in the U.S. States also have to send annual plans, recommitting that they will follow federal disability law. And then every year, they also have to reapply for the roughly $15 billion the federal government now sends to states to help them pay for special education services. All of this stuff, Michelle, goes through this one office, which is technically known as the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services. They play a huge role overseeing states. If staff worry a state has intentionally or unintentionally fallen out of compliance with the law, they step in. They even have trained customer service reps who answer calls directly from parents and families who worry their kids aren't getting the help at school they're legally entitled to. Without these staff, it is not clear any of this gets done.
What does the administration have to say about this?
They did not respond to multiple requests for comment. I will say President Trump has talked openly about wanting to return education to the states and close the education department. This move helps him do that if it's legal. As I said, federal law is very clear on this. Special education office has to exist, and it has to be housed at the education department. I also, for what it's worth, spoke with one state director of special education who told me, quote, "I'm fearful. I think it is good for states to know there is federal oversight."
And I mentioned earlier that you spoke over the weekend with half a dozen staffers who received RIF notices. What did they tell you?
Yeah, everyone I spoke to talked about how passionate their colleagues are. One told me, quote, "We fight tirelessly on behalf of kids with disabilities. This is not just a paycheck." They worried that gutting the office would lead to a, quote, "Wild West in special education," that some places might feel emboldened now to deny services to kids. More than anything, though, I heard a fear for parents and families who don't know their rights. As one wondered out loud to me, quote, "Who will families go to when there's nobody left?"
That is NPR education correspondent Corey Turner. Corey, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
You should give as you are able, because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time, this is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support. It's 5:42. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Weather today, mostly sunny, slight chance of showers early on the Iron Range, highs in the mid-50s with breezy west winds. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the low 30s, and tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the low 50s. Coming up this morning, we will honor Indigenous Peoples Day with a special Headwaters featuring the three non-blondes, a.k.a. the Humphrey family. That's happening from 10 to 11. It'll air again tonight at 11 p.m. Support for KAXE comes from Schroeder Log Home Supply, supplying wood home and cabin owners with specialty sealants, preservatives, and wood finishes. More information at their Grand Rapids store or online at loghelp.com. And we thank ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. The Beltrami County History Center hosts a panel discussion this Saturday at 10 a.m., Designing the Future, Women in Engineering. will highlight three women who are shaping the region's infrastructure and innovation. And there is a waffle brunch fundraiser for a new dog park in Deer River this Sunday, 9 to 1 at the Deer River Vets Club. Tickets available at the door or in advance at the Chocolate Dog. You can let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, maker of business management software with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez. There are three new winners of the Nobel Prize in Economics this morning. They were recognized for their work on how cycles of technological innovation feed economic growth. NPR's Scott Horsley was monitoring the announcement. Scott, who are the winners?
They are Joel Moker of Northwestern University, Peter Howitt of Brown University, and Philippe Aguillon, who divides his time between the College of France and the London School of Economics. All three men were born outside the United States, but they all got their doctorate degrees at American universities. And they'll split prize money of 11 million Swedish kroner, or about $1.2 million. Half of that will go to Moker, and the other half will be split between Howitt and Aguillon.
All right, tell us about their research.
Well, Moker pioneered a theory of how technological change and improvement has fueled two centuries of economic growth, and also the preconditions needed to make that happen, because, as he says, technology was changing before two centuries ago, and it was not leading to economic growth. Howitt and Aguillon then followed up with a theory of how creative destruction allows one technological advance to give way to another, so today's breakthrough becomes tomorrow's obsolete detritus. Sheersten Inflow of the Nobel Committee illustrated this with a slide of just how, for example, telephones have evolved over the last 200 years. So what was once a modern marvel now looks like an antique.
During the last 200 years, the world has seen more economic growth than ever before in human history. This growth has increased our living standards in so many different ways. But still, 200 years is still just a short period compared to the long-run history of stagnation that we saw before. The laureate's work reminds us that we should not take progress for granted.
Part of the work of these men is directed at policymakers to help create the conditions where innovation can flower and lead to economic growth, but also safety nets for those who might be displaced by creative destruction. They say it's important for economies to be open to new ideas and also to manage the potential conflicts that come with that.
Have the winners said anything yet?
Yes, we've heard from Philippe Aguillon, who joined the Nobel Committee during the award announcement. He has the advantage of being on European time, so he didn't get a 4 a.m. wake-up call. He was asked about potential roadblocks to innovation and growth going forward, and he pointed to the protectionist trade policies of the Trump administration as a possible impediment to economic advance.
Openness is a driver of growth. Anything that gets in the way of openness is an obstacle to growth. So I see there kind of dark clouds currently, accumulating, pushing for barriers to trade and openness.
Aguillon also pointed to artificial intelligence as a potential driver of economic growth going forward. But he said policymakers will have to take care to police AI so it doesn't wind up under the control of just a handful of players who could then work to block the next round of creative destruction. As always, Aguillon was asked how he plans to spend his share of the prize money. He says he's going to plow it into more research with some of his younger colleagues, planting the seeds of future innovation and growth and, of course, more creative destruction.
I wish one of those Nobel winners would just say, I want to buy a Lamborghini or Ferrari or something like that. That would be cool. NPR's chief economics correspondent, Scott Horsley. Scott, thanks.
You're welcome.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
was Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE. I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234 or go online to kaxe.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Pine Jamboree next Monday.
There are three winners of today's Nobel Economics Prize, and looking at their work, the two syllables AI come quickly to mind.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at progressive.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. There's word in the last hour that three professors who look at how innovation, including technology, drives economic growth will share the Nobel Economics Prize. It's Joel Mockyer of Northwestern University, Philippe Aguillon of France, who teaches in Paris and London, and Peter Howitt, a Canadian who works at Brown University in Providence. Their work also serves as a warning that history shows that growth is not inevitable and has to be nurtured. Marketplace's senior economics contributor Chris Farrell joins us now. Morning, Chris.
Good morning, David.
You've actually followed the work of at least one of these winners. Why'd they win?
These three, essentially economic historians, I mean, they have delved deep into the most important question in economics. What makes economies grow? What's behind technological change and innovation? What leads to long-term sustained economic growth?
Right. I mean, it's the most important economic question if this leads to bringing prosperity to actual human beings. Now, Joel Mockyer is a scholar that you've actually read into prior to this announcement.
Oh, and I would recommend for anybody to read his books, Lever Riches, a collection of essays, The Gifts of Athena. He's just a brilliant economic historian. And what he's delved into, David, is he looks at behind growth. It's not coal or capital, you know, money. It's when you look at the Industrial Revolution, it's a society that valued curiosity, experimentation, practical problem solving. Inventors and scientists were celebrated. It's about the importance of ideas and those institutions that support the ideas and the network effect of people exchanging ideas and their experiments.
When you look at the work of these three scholars, Joel Mockyer, Philippe Aguillon of France, and Peter Howitt at Brown, you know, the person I think of is Joseph Schumpeter, the Austrian economist, the creative destruction guy. Thought a lot about, for instance, entrepreneurship and how it plays into economic growth.
Right. And this is absolutely critical. I mean, growth is not steady. I mean, when you look, and you've looked at those charts, David, right, over 200 years where you can barely see the Great Depression in there, right? It looks remarkably smooth. But the closer you get to history and economic history, the more you realize, you know, new companies rise, old ones fall, entire industries are reshaped. And so Aguian, one of the things that he's well known for is looking about, you know, policies around education, competition, finance, how these affect whether societies get the kind of innovation that you want, the kind of innovation that leads to economic growth, or it may lead to economic destruction.
And Peter Howitt, I mean, he really also takes a very close look at economic history, focusing on the UK Industrial Revolution.
Yes, he's largely focused on Britain. And it's about, you know, you look over the past two centuries or so, you know, how do economies adapt to shocks, wars, new technologies? And one of the things that the Nobel Committee made very clear is one of the reasons why they awarded the prize to these economists at this particular point in time is largely the rise of AI and all the disruptions that AI may have for our society and what the impact may be on economic growth. So although these are economic historians, this is really a prize about a society and an economy of AI.
Marketplace's senior economics contributor, Chris Farrell. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Joel Machier gets half the Nobel Prize money. Philippe Aguillon and Peter Howitt split the other half. Markets after stock prices collapsed on Friday after China tightened up controls on rare earth exports and President Trump escalated rhetoric about the U.S.-China trade war. The S&P fell 2.7%. The Nasdaq closed down 3.6%. The Dow on Friday closed down 878 points or 1.9%. Then, over the weekend, Trump posted that the U.S. and China will work things out. And S&P futures are up 1.4% now. NASDAQ futures are up about 2%, about 2.5 hours here before the opening bell on Wall Street. So we're back to the condition when the whole market seems to turn on a few syllables this way or that on the Truth Social platform. The bond market is closed today for Columbus Day, Indigenous Peoples Day.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks delivers what's next in cybersecurity innovation to protect today's digital way of life. Learn more at paloaltonetworks.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
During unsettled economic times, there are programs that can immediately help individuals cover necessary costs, at least some of them. Economists call these programs automatic stabilizers. Unemployment insurance is one example. So is Medicaid. And then there's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP or indeed food stamps. As Marketplace's Carla Javier reports, that program is about to undergo some big changes that'll change who is able it is able to support.
Imagine a family. A parent loses their job, they go to the grocery store less. Diane Schanzenbach of Georgetown and Brookings says,
grocery stores see less demand, and so they have to do things like, you know, lay off a bag boy. And so those families, their incomes go down at the same time.
With SNAP, that first family buys those groceries and the bagger keeps their job. Earlier this month, the USDA notified states they need to make big changes to SNAP eligibility, work requirements, and who's covering costs soon. Colleen Heflin at Syracuse University says normally changes like these are rolled out with a lot of guidance over time. But
telling states October 3rd, you have to be in compliance November 1st, is impossible.
She says mistakes are going to be made, whether it's people losing benefits or just confusion.
And the administrative costs are going to go way up.
We reached out to the USDA for comment, and it did not respond. I'm Carla Javier for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. You can check out local news stories and conversations from our morning show. Our music team's monthly recap is up, and much more. Support comes from Edward Jones financial advisor Christina Gallas, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC. Weather today, mostly sunny. We do have a slight chance of showers early. Highs in the mid-50s with breezy west winds. Lows tonight, 30 to 33 with partly cloudy skies. And tomorrow, partly sunny with highs in the low 50s.